Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane you can walk right up to, out at the Udvar Hazy Center near Dulles. She sits there polished bright as a new dime, and most folks walk past her, not knowing they're looking at one of the most argued-over airplanes in the history of American aviation. Not because of what she did in the air, because of what it took to save her. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and this is the Hangar, where we tell the stories behind the machines. And today we're talking about the Enola Gay. Now, before you touch that dial, thinking you know exactly where this is going, give me the 20 minutes, because this isn't the story you think it is. This is the story of a restoration, a 20-year, 300,000-hour restoration that damn near tore the Smithsonian in half. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Let me set the scene for you. The airplane herself is a Boeing B-29 Superfortress, but not just any B-29. She's one of what they called the Silver Plate airplanes. That was the code name for a special run of Superfortresses, modified for one job and one job only. The bomb bays were reconfigured. Most of the gun turrets were stripped off to save weight. She got fuel-injected engines and reversible propellers. The good stuff, the latest and best Boeing could bolt on. 46 of them were built to that standard. This one rolled out of the Martin plant at Bellevue, Nebraska, in the spring of 1945. Colonel Paul Tibbetts picked her off the assembly line himself, and the morning before the mission he had his mother's name painted on the nose. Enola Gay. You know what she did on the 6th of August, 1945? I'm not going to dwell on Hiroshima this morning, because that's a different show and a heavier one, and every one of you carries your own thoughts about it. What I want to talk about is what happened to the airplane after the war. Because that, friends, is a story most people have never heard. Here's the thing about the Enola Gay. She was famous the instant she landed back on Tinian. And you'd think a famous airplane would get taken care of. You'd be wrong. After the war, she bounced around. She flew back to the States. She sat out in the weather at Davis-Monthan in Arizona. In 1949, Tibbetts himself flew her to Chicago and formally handed her over to the Smithsonian. And then the Smithsonian had a problem. They had this enormous, historic 141-foot wingspan airplane and absolutely nowhere to put her. So she went into storage. And storage for the Enola Gay meant Andrews Field, out in the open, rain, snow, sun, baking that aluminum. Summer after summer, birds got in, insects got in, and worse than the weather, people got in. Souvenir hunters, they pried off instruments, they cut pieces of the skin, somebody stole gauges right out of the panel. Now here's where it gets interesting. In 1961, they finally moved her indoors to a storage facility at Suitland, Maryland, a place the restoration crews came to call the Silver Hill Boneyard, and they took her apart to get her inside, disassembled the whole airplane, wings off, engines off, fuselage in sections, and there she sat, broken down into pieces, for decades. Think about that, the airplane that ended the biggest war in human history, lying in pieces in a Maryland warehouse, growing corrosion while the country argued about whether it even wanted to look at her. The man who finally got the ball rolling was a fellow named Paul Garber. Garber was the Smithsonian's curator, the founding spirit of what became the National Air and Space Museum, and the storage facility is named for him to this day. But it was the crews under the restoration shop who did the real sweat work, and in 1984, they started Pull Up a Chair, because I want you to understand the scale of what these people took on.
When they opened up the sections, it was worse than anybody feared. The magnesium castings had corroded. There was bird droppings and animal nests packed into the airframe. Rubber components had turned to tar or crumbled to dust. The rubber fuel tanks, the self-sealing bladders, had rotted. Wiring insulation had gone brittle. And there was corrosion, that white powdery aluminum cancer, all through her. These technicians, and I want to say their names matter even when we don't know them all, they worked in a shop out at Silver Hill and later at a new facility, disassembling components down to the individual piece. Every bolt, every bracket, every cable, they cleaned each part by hand, they stripped corrosion, they replated hardware. When a part was too far gone, they fabricated a new one to the original Boeing drawings, and they kept the old one tagged and boxed, because in real restoration you don't throw history away, you preserve it even when you can't use it. The engines alone, four right, R3350 duplex cyclones, 18 cylinders each, twin-row radials, the same troublesome magnificent engines that gave B-29 crews fits during the war because they loved to catch fire. Each one of those engines was torn down to the case and rebuilt, cleaned, inspected, corrosion-treated, reassembled, they logged, and this is the number that stops me every time, more than 300,000 staff hours on this airplane. Some accounts put it around 300,000 hours of labor stretched across nearly 20 years. 1984 to 2003. That is not a restoration. That is a life's work, handed from one craftsman to the next. And while those men and women were bent over corroded castings with dental picks and solvent, breathing that sharp smell of stripper and clean metal, out in the wider world a different kind of fight had broken out. And it got loud, because in the early 1990s, the Air and Space Museum decided the 50th anniversary of the end of the war was the time to finally put the Enola Gay's forward fuselage on display. And they planned an exhibit around her. And that exhibit became one of the most bitter public fights over history this country has ever seen.
You had veterans groups, the men who'd actually done the fighting, who looked at the proposed exhibit and felt it put the airplane on trial. You had historians who felt the full weight of what the airplane did had to be shown. You had the Air Force Association, members of Congress, newspaper editorial boards, all of them going at it. The museum's director eventually resigned over it. The big exhibit was canceled. And in 1995, what finally went on display was just the restored forward fuselage and a much simpler presentation. The airplane, the physical object those craftsmen had labored over, got caught in a crossfire that had nothing to do with rivets and corrosion and everything to do with memory. I'm not here to referee that fight. I flew for a living. I'm a stick and rudder man. But I'll tell you what I take from it. That airplane mattered so much that people couldn't even agree on how to stand in a room with her. And through all of it, the quiet professionals in the restoration shop just kept working, kept cleaning parts, kept turning wrenches. The politics raged over their heads and they finished the job. The last piece of the puzzle came when the museum opened the Stephen F. Udvar Hazy Center out by Dulles Airport in December of 2003, a hangar big enough, finally, to hold her whole. And they brought all the sections together, wings and engines and fuselage, and for the first time since the early 1960s, the Enola Gay was one complete airplane again. Reassembled, whole, standing on her own gear if you go see her, and I think every one of you should at least once walk down the length of that wing, 141 feet, tip to tip. Look at how the light comes off that bare metal. And then think about the fact that every square foot of that skin passed through somebody's hands. Somebody cleaned it, treated it, and set it back exactly where Boeing put it 80 years ago.
That's the part that gets me. We argue about what airplanes mean. We should. That's healthy. But somebody has to actually save the thing first, or there's nothing left to argue about. The restorer doesn't get the headline. The restorer gets the corrosion and the 300,000 hours and the dental picks. And because of that patient unglamorous work, your grandkids can stand next to a piece of the 20th century and decide for themselves what to feel. That's what a museum airplane really is. Not a trophy, not a verdict. Just the actual object, saved, so the conversation never has to end. My thanks to the National Air and Space Museum's own records on the restoration, to the accounts left by the Silver Hill crews, and to the Histories of the Silver Plate program for the details in today's segment. You can find more of what we do over at radiohangar.com. Go look at the old airplanes while they're still standing. Somebody worked awfully hard so you could. This has been The Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger.